Malcolm Gladwell is the author of 5 New York Times bestsellers, including The Tipping Point, Blink, Outliers, and his latest, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. He has been named one of the top most influential people by Time magazine and one of foreign policy's top global thinkers. In The Tipping Point, he explored how ideas spread. In Blink, he explored decision-making. And in Outliers, he explored the roots of success. With his newest book, David and Goliath, he examines our understanding of the advantages of disadvantages, arguing that we have underestimated the value of adversity and overestimated the value of privilege. Now, for you and me, writing a New York Times bestseller would be the achievement of a lifetime. So how does Malcolm Gladwell do it time after time? How does he sustain peak performance in his creative output? In this interview, we'll explore what it takes to operate at peak creativity day after day. Malcolm, welcome to the Peak Performance Summit. So let's start with reflecting on some of the lessons and ideas from your most recent book, David and Goliath, and then also we'll talk later about how you sustain that creativity, article after article, book after book. In David and Goliath, you begin with that classic story of how David wins the battle against this enormous giant Goliath, even though at first glance, Goliath has much more power. So give us a quick overview of the paradoxes of power you explore in this book.
Yeah. The first one is that is a misunderstanding based on our kind of historical distance from that story. In ancient times, the sling that David chooses to use against Goliath was considered one of the most devastating weapons available. Armies use slingers, whole fleets of slingers, particularly against infantry. The calculation I talked to this one ballistics expert who calculated that the rock leaving David's sling would have stopping power equal to a .38 caliber handgun. So it's not a child's toy he's got. In fact, it's superior technology to what Goliath has. And by changing the rules and bringing this sling to what was supposed to be a sword fight, David has done what insurgents or underdogs typically do, right? Which is violate convention. The second thing that's interesting is that Goliath is not who he seems to be. There's this really fascinating speculation among endocrinologists about whether Goliath has a condition called acromegaly, which is a tumor on your pituitary gland, which causes overproduction of human growth hormone. That would account for his size. And people typically who are that much taller than their peers often do have acromegaly. But the side effect of acromegaly is very often restriction of vision. And there's tons of clues in the Bible story that God can't see. Why is he led onto the valley floor by an attendant?
Yes.
Why does he keep yelling out to David, come to me, come to me? And so you add those together and you realize, wait a minute, a guy with superior technology has changed the rules and advanced on a giant who can't see him, so doesn't know what's up. That's not a story of a once-in-a-lifetime, one-in-a-million upset victory. That's a battle that looks a lot more like something where David had an equal, if not a greater, chance of winning from the outset.
Well, you know, you look at that story initially, and then you look at a whole bunch of other stories in which we've been examining the outlines of these stories for years or decades or centuries. And yet, Malcolm, what fascinates me is you're the guy who sees in the commonplace story the anomaly, that clue, that what we think is the lesson there isn't really the lesson, that much more is going on there than is first the case. How did that, in this particular case, how did those clues first click into your brain as being important?
Well, some of it is, you know, it's all fueled by the by simple, very, very simple curiosity. I love nothing more than rooting around in a library or calling up obscure experts on obscure things on the phone and or going to see them. Because I know from experience that even if you think you're not going to get anything interesting, you probably will. That there's more, there's always the great lesson of being a, that I learned as a journalist for years and years and years at the Washington Post was if you look underneath the surface, you will always find stuff you didn't know was there. So it was mostly, you know, in this case of David and Glass story, I was like, well, you know, I think I know what the story's about, but I should really go and root around and read what people who studied the story have to say about it. And of course, the literature on that story is I mean, it's this hilarious free-for-all among ballistics experts, endocrinologists, neurologists, you know, experts in ancient warfare, biblical scholars, and you realize, oh, wait, this is really fun. And that's when you start to, you know, to figure out that you can say something new.
And then also to separate the wheat from the chaff, to read, look at all that material, and then it takes something, takes an expert eye to figure out what's the chaff, what's the wheat, and then out of that huge mass of material, pick out the thread of the story, and then tell it well. I really admire the way you do that, and you do that in this book in all kinds of ways. It's remarkable how you apply this to many different domains of society and civilization and psychology, and draw common conclusions from very, very disparate sources. One of the things you talk about near the start of the book is how we assume that more is better, more wealth, more education, more power, and so on. And you say it's a paradox that it can be, but there's a point at which it stops being better. So that whole foundational idea of our society that more is better is one you really challenge, and you show how it's better up to a point. So yeah. Talk about that, how that idea, you know, that you have these diagrams in the book showing how the line goes up and up and up and up, more and more and more and more, until something happens. Let's go ahead and talk about that whole concept that more is better and the limits of that paradigm.
Well, it's what your mother always told you, right? Everything in moderation. And so I sort of sought to explore this notion because I felt like one of the mistakes that people in positions of authority make, or Goliaths make, is they assume that the advantage they have in material wealth or resources will consistently give them a leg up on their opponent. And I challenge this by looking at a couple of examples where having more is only useful up to a point, and then it can actually hurt you. Classic example, class size. If a class is really large and you spend a lot more money to make it smaller, the kids in the class will do better. There's no question about that. But you can't keep making classes smaller and expect that effect to keep going. At a certain point, a class can become too small, and the outcomes of the children in that classroom will then start to become worse, not better. And we think that when classes get too far below 20 kids, the same thing that used to make for a better educational environment goes in reverse. You don't have enough kids to have good discussion. You have so few kids that one child who's particularly disruptive can dominate. You've got so few kids that if you're struggling, what you really need in order to feel like you're part of the discussion is someone who's struggling alongside you, who's asking the same questions, having the same problems. Class gets too small, the chances of you having a real peer get really small as well. So there's all this, I could go on, but there's all these sort of reasons why you can't keep, in other words, you cannot keep spending money on perpetuity on education and expect things to keep improving. After a while, your wealth starts to backfire, or the things you can buy with your wealth. And I think this is true of lots and lots of cases. You know, after a while, if a company gets too large, does its size start to undermine its creativity, its nimbleness? Yes, absolutely. Everyone at GM will tell you GM got too big. I'm sure everyone at Microsoft right now thinks that Microsoft is too big. You know, this is a phenomenon that I think we can find over and over again in society. It's totally common sense, and yet it is a rule that is routinely violated.
Yes, and you look at companies like Apple, which, as they grow, really struggle to maintain that sense of innovation, that sense of freshness and newness. Yes. And some of them do succeed much further along the growth path than others. Others succumb to that sclerotic disease much sooner, but others manage to keep it alive, or at least recognize the importance of keeping that innovation alive. But this is really counter to our usual thinking, which is that more is better, and that'll keep on going. You also introduced the whole concept of the bell curve, that line starts to diminish and dip down, and that bell curve is a powerful idea in many different kinds of endeavors. Go ahead and give us some other examples you use of the bell curve and how it plays out in different parts of society.
Yeah, the technical term that scientists love to use is the inverted U-shaped curve. So it's clear, for example, that I talk a lot about this with respect to parenting. If you have no money, being an effective, a good parent is hard. You're under an incredible amount of stress. You don't have a chance to give your child access to certain kinds of opportunities. As I give you more money, being a good parent gets easier. But that relationship doesn't go on forever. There is, if a parent starts to get too much money, the job of parent gets harder again. And I talk about that. You can't pinpoint with perfect accuracy what that turning point is. But I had a fascinating discussion with a guy who's a psychiatrist who works with the children of wealthy parents, wealthy families. And he talked at length about this, that, you know, if you have $50 million and your child asks you for a pony and you think it's a bad idea, you have to be able to articulate, you can't say you can't have a pony, because you can, obviously you can afford it. You have to say, I won't get you a pony. I have chosen not to, even though I could. And that requires you to articulate to your child all the reasons why getting everything you want is not a good idea. If you are a middle-class family and your kid asks you for a pony and the pony's a bad idea, you don't have to come up with any reasons at all. You have to you shrug and you say, can't afford it.
Right.
I was growing up, I could have asked for a Ferrari, and my father would just have laughed in my face.
Right.
But if my father was Warren Buffett and I asked for a Ferrari, he actually has to tell me why I can't get a Ferrari. That's not impossible, but it's hard. You have to have skills as a parent when you're rich that you don't have to have when you're middle class. I don't think, and I had a long discussion with a very wealthy guy about this very problem. And very few people, as they acquire wealth, think about this and recognize how the task of raising fulfilled, disciplined, hardworking kids is going to grow more difficult once they get past a certain income level.
I know that watching kids who, for example, get new cars when they graduate high school, or another example I heard recently was from a psychologist who works with an Indian tribe, and mm-hmm. dropout rates are really a problem in the tribe, and education's a real priority for the tribe. So they began giving the kids who graduate in their tribe $100,000 for finishing high school. it's a staggering thing, you know, to think about that. Is that necessarily a good thing?
I'd love to see the data on that.
Yeah, there are paradoxes here, and I'd watch those kids getting the cars when they finished high school, or looking at kids who had enormous privilege, and it definitely seemed to have an effect on their later self-efficacy. I had one kind of chilling experience in New York, on your end of the world, when I was in graduate school, and I met this guy who was a trust fund baby, and I thought, wow, this guy lives in this building, trust fund babies, had no need to work his whole life, what an enviable position. And he had a dog, and he'd take his dog out every day and take the dog for a walk, feed the dog, and the dog obviously meant a lot to him. So as we began to talk about his life and the dog, he said, Dawson, what you don't understand is I do take the dog out for a walk every day. I do feed the dog. This is the only important thing I've done my entire life.
Wow.
Everything else has been handed to me. This is the only significant thing I've done for the world, for myself, for the dog, for anyone, my entire life. That was a very sobering experience for me and made me realize that that those things we think of as being a great advantage are not necessarily a great advantage. So go and talk about this whole idea that strategies that work so well for people, like wealth acquisition, have their limits, that the very thing that like military power or wealth or whatever it might be, that is such a good thing in the initial doses might become counterproductive in larger ones.
Yeah. Well, you can. I mean, in my book, you know, I had this conversation with this fascinating conversation with a guy, so a very successful guy in Hollywood, and came from a middle to lower middle class family. And we spent the first half an hour or hour of our interview in which he just talked about his childhood, about how, because his family did not have much, he was forced from a very young age to learn the meaning of work and learn the meaning of money, and to make a connection between the two, to see how by sacrificing and being disciplined and showing initiative, you could earn money and in so doing feel fulfilled, feel like you were contributing to the world, make a difference, feel like you had a purpose, all those kinds of things. And those lessons were crucial in his career. In his career, he ended up amassing hundreds of millions of dollars. But he was saying, you know, every one of those crucial lessons is now denied my own children. They never had to have, you know, he used to shovel snow for all of his neighbors starting at the age of like 8 or 9, a standard thing that countless kids across America did when they were that age. His kids never had to shovel snow, right? They never had to, that sounds like a very trivial thing. It's not, because I feel like the kinds of principles that underlie how we achieve satisfaction and fulfillment in the world are laid down very early. And to be able at the age of 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever, to make a connection between your own effort and a reward is one of the single greatest gifts you can get from your childhood.
So if you're getting a reward without the effort, then you never cement that circuit in your brain.
You never do. You never do. And the way he made it sound, and I think it's right, that, you know, we were in this extraordinary mansion in Los Angeles, and I realized it was a kind of prison for his kids. It wasn't, denied them all kinds of experiences that people with much less money get for free, right?
You know, I'm fascinated by Warren Buffett because he's often regarded as the most successful investor in America, and he's lampooned sometimes by hedge fund managers and mutual fund managers because he lives in the same house in Omaha, Nebraska, that he's had his whole married life, and whereas other executives of far lesser means would charter jets, have their own private jets. For many years, he flew coach class wherever he went to travel, and he did eventually succumb. And he said that it was actually a smart move to get his own jet. But he's manipulating all this wealth, yet he doesn't have that need to turn it into ostentatious display, and he's doing it for you get the impression for the fun of it as well as for the leverage it gives him.
Yeah. No, I think he understands that. Part of what explains his ability to be so extraordinarily productive and successful late in his life, I think, is that he has made a deliberate attempt to keep those kinds of psychological conditions in play.
So as you grow in wealth or security, you actually may then have to exert yourself, you may have to deliberately and consciously plan how to maintain the kind of psychology that allows you to be in touch with the satisfaction that those gifts bring.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's very true. You can see this on every level. Just as there are perils when countries get too big and powerful and perils to companies that get too big and powerful, there are also real psychological perils to individuals, families that achieve great wealth. And I think one of the things that has set someone like Buffett apart is that I think he had an intuitive understanding of that from the beginning.
Well, in terms of countries, one of the biggest comeuppances recently in foreign policy, of course, has been the Iraq War, which graphically showed us the limits of power and the difficulty of combating a determined insurgency. You talk about this as well, and you show how that you think that when very strong countries fight very weak countries, the strong country always prevails. But according to the research you cite, actually about a third of the time, the weaker country prevails. And if the weaker country uses unconventional methods, it prevails two-thirds of the time. Again, that's really counterintuitive because you think the country with the most tanks, guns, armaments, money, power, resources, and so on will win. Go ahead and talk about that whole point about why these unconventional tactics seem to turbocharge the ability of the underdog to prevail.
Yeah, I mean, it goes to this idea that when we look at any kind of contest between two parties, I think our kind of intuitive sense of where advantage lies is often wrong. So if you look at the history of wars between countries that differ in size by at least 10 times, so very big countries and very small countries, what you discover is what you just said, is that in those contests, apparently lopsided contests, if the smaller country fights unconventionally, fights essentially a guerrilla war, they will win the majority of the time. In other words, what matters in combat is not material resources. What matters are psychological factors. How you choose to fight and how long you're willing to fight and what kind of sacrifices you're willing to bear. That's a hard lesson, weirdly, for us to grasp. You know, in other words, if the United States chooses to fight Vietnam or Iraq or any number of other apparently very, very small countries, there is no reason going in to presume that the United States is the favorite. That's what history should tell us. If the United States were to invade Canada tomorrow, there is no reason to presume, based on the historical record, that America is the likely winner in that conflict. And I say that as a Canadian, so I'm biased in this matter. But yeah, no, that's weird, because, and this is one of the things that I grapple with in this book, is we have all of this evidence in our lives of how what we think of as an advantage is not often really an advantage. And yet we seem to kind of ignore it. We don't take it seriously.
Yes. We operate as though we make a sort of a zero-sum calculation of the advantages of each side, and we operate on that assumption in so many areas of our lives, when in fact that assumption is totally wrong. And we keep on making this mistake over and over and over again. It's astonishing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. It's really a. I mean, it's a. It's. I never really sort of. In this book, I examine that question and walk around it. I don't think anyone can fundamentally get to the bottom of it. What is it about? Why is our view of the world at its root so kind of flawed? And flawed is almost too weak a word. Out of kilter.
It's misinformed, and it stays misinformed despite the evidence we have to the contrary. We keep on making that calculation over and over and over again. We keep looking at which athlete has the biggest muscles or the fastest response time. We miss those subtleties over and over and over again. It's quite an astonishing phenomenon that's the way our brains seem to work.
Yeah, no, I think it's true.
Now, one fascinating step further you take this concept is the idea, you coin this term desirable difficulties to describe the concept that our disadvantages can actually be advantages. And when I first read that, I thought, why would you wish some of these difficulties on yourself or your kids? But it turns out that overcoming those can help them. So talk about those desirable difficulties and how those can paradoxically be put to our advantage.
Yeah, this is a phrase that was conceived by these two really brilliant psychologists at UCLA called Bjorks. And they've talked about this in learning theory, that sometimes when I make things easier for you when you're learning something, I improve your ability to learn. But sometimes the opposite is true. Sometimes the best way to improve your ability to learn something is to make the act of learning harder. And that's called a desirable difficulty. Sometimes when I raise the bar just a little bit, it forces you to concentrate more, to be more disciplined, to focus, to go over things in your mind, to pause before jumping to conclusions. And those are all ultimately good things. So I asked the question about, are there handicaps in the world that are best described or can be understood to be desirable? And I looked at dyslexia and at this kind of fascinating fact that some fraction, not all, not even a majority, but some fraction of dyslexics go on to have extraordinarily successful lives. And if you ask them why, they will tell you it is because of their handicap, not in spite of it. In other words, that their dyslexia was a desirable difficulty, not an undesirable one. That, to me, is a really, really, really interesting notion.
Tell us one of the stories you tell of actual cases you studied of people who had that experience.
Well, I tell the story, for example, of the great trial lawyer, David Boies, who is perhaps America's best trial lawyer, who is profoundly dyslexic and has real difficulty reading. And you have this puzzle. The guy's a lawyer, and he reads maybe one book a year. And so I asked him, how on earth did you get your law degree or even succeed as a lawyer? And he said, well, because of what my dyslexia taught me. First of all, it taught me how to listen, and it also taught me how to develop my memory. The way he got through school was by sitting, listening, and committing to memory everything that teachers said, right? Because he couldn't read the textbook. Those two skills allow him to scrape through school and scrape through law school, but then when he's in the courtroom, all of a sudden, they're the biggest advantages in the world, right? Because what is being a trial lawyer? It is listening to someone, committing what they say to memory, really listening to every nuance and committing what they say to memory and being able to engage them in real time and confront them when they say things that aren't true or that require elaboration. So he looks at his extraordinary skills as a trial lawyer and says, I know where that comes from. And two of the most crucial skills I have are things I developed only because I was robbed of the ability to read. And I found versions of that story over and over again with entrepreneurs, with Hollywood producers, with, you know, Wall Street traders, you name it. It's really fascinating.
So that would lead us to a whole different attitude toward and view of our own deficits in life. Rather than complaining about them and wish we didn't have them, we can give thanks for them. We can find a way of turning them to our advantage, or at least accepting ourselves the way we are. Carl Rogers, the great family therapist, said that the paradox of human growth is that it begins with accepting yourself exactly the way you are. When you accept yourself the way you are, you then begin to grow. So I guess that the lesson for us there is to, however you are, whatever your seeming deficits, accept them, and they may be forcing you to develop other abilities which, were not for those deficits, you might never be pursuing.
No, I think that's exactly right.
Give us another example of a desirable difficulty that actually spurs and triggers evolution and growth.
Well, I looked at this really fascinating and complicated question of parental loss. There have been these studies of very successful people, groups, so British prime ministers, American presidents, you look at these people who've achieved that extraordinary position as a group, and you find that they have people who have reached that level are far more likely than the general population to have lost a parent in childhood. Right? Now that's weird, because losing a parent in childhood is just about the most devastating thing that can happen to someone. And all kinds of really bad outcomes are associated with losing a parent. Much higher rate of depression, of dropping out of school, of mental illness, of you name it. There's just nothing good one would normally comes of that. And yet when we look at these people who have been extraordinarily successful, we find the same thing. And what that suggests is that there are a small number of people for whom parental loss is a desirable difficulty, that the experience of having to work through that extraordinary tragedy at a very young age, in some small percentage of cases, so strengthens and emboldens and empowers people that they have a big leg up in when they go on into the world, into the real world. They learn that what they're capable of. They become hardened to adversity. They are required to grow up much faster. There's all kinds of things that happen which end up being extraordinarily advantageous. That does not mean they are happier. In fact, as a group, these people may be profoundly unhappy. In fact, there was a famous study of English prime ministers which basically concluded that as a group, they are just about the most unhappy people you'll ever find. So we're not talking about happiness. We're talking about career success. It's an important distinction. But, you know, it's like Nietzsche said, anything that does not kill me makes me stronger.
Yeah, Malcolm, there's a concept in coaching called self-efficacy, and that is the belief that you have the power to make change, shift, set goals, and attain them. And in the absence of one parent, that might well be triggering the development of self-efficacy much sooner than having the support of both parents for your whole childhood.
Yeah, I think that's... And what the really fascinating question is, what predicts why some people react to parental loss in that positive way, and what predicts those who don't? That's another one of these fascinating questions which I think we can only guess at.
Yes. Yeah, and of course that whole phenomenon that two people, when confronted with the same experience, whether it's positive, negative, or neutral, may respond very, very differently. One might use it as grist for the mill, grow and transform through it. It can destroy another person. But my own field of study is post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and one of the intriguing questions we've been looking at for the last decade is why, when you expose people to combat, do some come back with PTSD? About a quarter of them come back with clinical PTSD. 3/4 of them don't come back with clinical PTSD, having had exactly the same experiences. And a few of them were now just starting to explore this idea on the very frontier of psychology called post-traumatic growth, that there are some people for whom not only does it not trigger PTSD, is it not just neutral, they actually go on to have profound personal positive change as a result of the same experiences that destroy other people. So this whole that's the paradox. It's why do some experiences have such a corrosive effect on people, and yet on other people, those same experiences will not have that effect, and in fact might even lead to greater attainment. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Isn't that interesting? It's so fascinating. I wish I'd had this conversation with you when I was writing my book, because that's exactly the kind of variation, heterogeneity that I'm interested in. The same, I talk about how the Londoners reacted to the Blitz, and why didn't everyone predicted before the war that if the Germans bombed London, the overwhelming majority of Londoners would panic and flee for the countryside and the war would be over. That did not happen. And so why didn't it happen? Because not everyone had the same response to being bombed. Some people found it utterly traumatic and were scarred and never recovered. And others got stronger. Others emerged unscathed and went around thinking that no one could kill them. And you know, it sounds flip to put it that way, but that's exactly what happened. And it's the same thing you're describing, that two people can experience exactly the same event and have profoundly different responses to it. And I you know, the great challenge of 20th century medicine was to describe fundamental human processes. I think the great challenge of 21st century psychology and medicine is to describe the variation in human responses to things. And that's what we're getting at here is, you know, two soldiers can come out of combat. One is floored by their experience. The other is emboldened by it. How is that possible? It's a fantastic question.
It also does really bear on both medicine and psychology. It's not just psychological. There was a study published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences showing that if teenage boys have higher levels of salivary cortisol, that predicts depression. They're 14 times more likely to be depressed as adults. And so there's this strong result. There's a strong correlation, not just between psychological factors like depression, but physiological ones like cortisol. High cortisol correlates with increased chances of risk of heart disease and cancer and all kinds of diabetes, all kinds of negative physiological consequences later in life. So if you lower your cortisol, then all of those things are better. So we're more and more realizing that the physiology is psychology, and if you can get a handle on these kinds of psychological issues when you go through these challenging experiences, they're going to have a beneficial effect on your physiology and your medical outcomes later on in life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No.
I think that's a great project for the next period in medicine and psychology. Now, one thing I'm really curious about is you are looking at the same set of facts, the same pieces of information that everyone else sees. This information is publicly available. Like when I was growing up, I read about the Troubles in Northern Ireland. I read all the same information. And yet I never made the connections that you make between why, for example, increased military action in Northern Ireland produced exactly the opposite of the intended effect. When you tell the story in the book, it's like, oh, now I see it. But you know, what I'm asking here isn't so much about the facts, but about your mental process, Malcolm. How do you come to look at the same information everyone else is staring at, yet come to often counterintuitive and very different conclusions about what's driving that?
Mm-hmm. How do I? Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm trained as a journalist, and that's what journalists are supposed to do. Unless we can tell our audience something new, we don't serve any function. So that's part of it. Part of it as well is that in many of the fields that I'm writing about, I'm an outsider to them. And there's incredible advantages to being an outsider. I don't know what the conventional wisdom is. I'm not beholden to it. Do you know what I mean? I'm not even aware. Sometimes if I write something that may seem, particularly, novel in its perspective, half the time I don't even realize it's novel, because I don't even, you know what I mean? I'm just sort of someone who has walked into something, looked around and perceived it a certain way and written about it, and only later learned that it may seem like an unusual perspective. It's a lot easier to be unusual, in other words, when you're from the outside, when you have that kind of that perspective.
Yes, every field has its established wisdom, its established paradigm, and when you're outside of that paradigm, you often can see things that people within the paradigm can't see. I'm curious, though, when you have a hot new idea, what does it feel like? Do you know you're onto something when you say read a piece of information or you have a thought and have an idea? Does some part of your being just light up and you say, aha, I'm on the trail of something big here?
It takes a long time to kind of, so I have, like, right now, this weekend I went to the library and I'm really interested in peer effects and the idea that your peers can influence you in any number of ways. And the assumptions we have about peer effects, particularly in education, are really lame. Like, most parents will say, I want my kid to be around the smartest possible group of peers. But that behind that is an assumption that says that it's a, you know, the smarter your peers, the smarter you are. But in fact, that's not the way the world works at all, right? So, you know, just intuitively, I know that sometimes the most effective peers I had were the ones who embodied a behavior that I wasn't interested at all, right? Some of the most powerful, like, it was from my peers who were using drugs that I got the idea that I never wanted to use drugs. Negative peer experiences can be even more powerful than positive ones. Or why is it, I have to go into this in the book, it's not necessarily a good idea to be surrounded by really, really smart people. Sometimes it's far more effective for your own self-efficacy for you to be the smartest person in the room, right? Which is a very different idea about what kind of peer responses you want. The point is, so I'm just interested in this at the moment. Will it lead anywhere? Maybe not. In all likelihood, probably not. But for the next couple of weeks, I'm going to read about this and turn it over in my mind, and maybe there's a way to come up with something, but maybe I'll just put it aside. But that's why I do that all the time. You know, I kind of have an idea in my head and read and think about it, talk to people about it, and then sometimes something develops and sometimes something doesn't.
So it may take a while to gestate below the surface then.
To my mind, time is a huge factor in everything I do. I try to build in as much time as possible for this kind of reflection.
You know, one thing about peer effects that strikes me is we've been, in PTSD research, we've been mulling over the results of one study published, actually isn't published yet, will be published soon, but it was a group of veterans, mostly Vietnam veterans, and their spouses. And they went through a series of 7-day retreats. And when they went in, about 83% of them had clinical PTSD. When we followed them up 6 weeks after the retreats, only 28% of the veterans had PTSD. And going in, about a third of the spouses had PTSD. So living with a Vietnam veteran for 40 years has produced PTSD in the spouse. But afterwards, only about 4% of the spouses had PTSD. And we were absolutely just gobsmacked by this result, because it's like normally in all of our other research, you see PTSD reduce and then it levels off if you're successful at treating it. But it doesn't usually get better. This was the first study showing that these people not only recovered during the retreat, but in the six weeks after the retreat, they kept on getting better. And like, we're running around crazy. Why is this happening? And all we can find as an answer is that peer effect, that wounded people, psychologically wounded people, supporting each other and sharing with each other seems to be reinforcing the healing process. So it's not, wasn't being with the healthy people that helped them. We're seeing other wounded veterans recover. Yeah. And then the spouses interacting with each other and with other spouses and other veterans. So these peer effects, I think you're onto something here. These peer effects we're speculating as a result of this research may be extraordinarily powerful in reinforcing positive psychological change.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because my intuition would have been totally different, which would have been the single most important thing for someone suffering from PTSD is to hang out with people who are quote-unquote normal, so they can relearn the norms of, right? So my intuitive peer notion would have led you in exactly the wrong direction. And I wonder how often we do that, you know?
That's the great thing about research. We put these questions to the research test, and sometimes the conventional wisdom is totally wrong. Other times it's right, but sometimes it's full of surprises. And until you've done the research, you don't really know which way the coin will turn up.
Yeah.
But following the rabbit through the rabbit hole is so interesting, because you then find fact after fact after fact. Some of them conform to your preconceived notions, others challenge them. And that's, I think, what makes for a fascinating creative project. I'm curious, besides this peer effect, idea, what are you working on currently?
Well, I've just finished a piece for The New Yorker about, remember the Waco fire, Branch Davidians?
Yes.
David Koresh. I just did a piece about that, which is all about the failure of the FBI's failure in negotiating with the Branch Davidians, the fact that they could not conceive that the Branch Davidians might be sincere in their beliefs, which I thought was really kind of a fascinating insight about the inability of many of us, all of us, to take contrary beliefs seriously, to value the sincerity of those who are have chosen to distance themselves from the mainstream. We always want to kind of, faced with that kind of extremism, we always try and denigrate it, to say, to look on it as cynically, or look on it as self-serving, or, and it's hard for us to wrap our minds around the fact that someone may believe some crazy thing or strange thing or eccentric thing and be genuine in their belief. It's a really fascinating little case study in a kind of the difficulty the majority has sometimes.
Yes, because those beliefs seem so hard to square with the world as it is. And so to, you know, I meet people of faith sometimes, and they believe things that I just simply couldn't believe myself, and yet I have to respect the fact that they well and truly believe them, even though my mind has difficulty reconciling that with the evidence of reason. So you can discount those things, but if you do, it's to your peril.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely the case.
And when governments, of course, discount those, like you talk about in Northern Ireland, when governments discount the value of connection, of community, of shared experience, the results can be tragic.
Yeah, that is the story of Northern Ireland. I mean, I chose that to write about in my book because I think it is this kind of powerful case study and so many lessons for those in power about the ways their power can mislead them.
Yeah, and you weave it in with things like the three strikes laws about high school basketball. I'm just so intrigued by the way you weave so many different storylines together and show the common threads between them all. I'd love to close, Malcolm, by having you talk directly to us about what advice you'd give us about sparking our own creativity. How do you know you're not only writing books, but you have some leisure and you have some time to reflect. You're also writing deadline-driven pieces for The New Yorker, and you have to produce a stream of creative output day after day, week after week. And I don't think your well is in any great danger of running dry, but what would you tell people who want to find those kinds of wellsprings of creativity in themselves? What do you do to spark that? What can you do to nourish that in yourself and really induce that kind of creative output yourself?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one is to understand that the amount of deliberate activity is necessary to lay the groundwork for creativity. I mean, you have to go out of your way to expose yourself to things that challenge your worldview. It doesn't happen by accident. And the crucial thing, as well as that notion of challenge your worldview, you have to be willing to put what you think you know up for scrutiny. And if necessary to, you know, I have done a U-turn. If you read all of my books, you will find that I say things in this book that are directly contrary to things I said in previous books. To my mind, that is a good thing. It's a sign that I'm still intellectually alive. So that's part of it. And the other thing is what I was talking about, the time thing is so crucial. I don't think that, creativity happens, at least in my case, it does not happen quickly. I have to kind of find ways to give myself opportunities for rumination and reflection and all those things. And that's the scarcest commodity in the world we live in now, is time, particularly quiet time, right? So finding, carving out spaces for quiet time is crucial.
And how do you do that personally?
Well, it's about planning your day and about making sure there are big chunks of when I work out, I work out, or when I go for a run, I don't ever take an iPod, there's nothing in my ears. There are big chunks of every day where I'm by myself. I try every day to have lunch by myself, so I can sit and just think and muse and let my mind wander. And you can't, I don't think you can lead a creative life unless you build in those kinds of moments.
Do you feel pressure to produce?
No, because it's fun. I don't think anything that is enjoyable has pressure. To me, pressure is only associated with things that you don't want to do. So.
So you can get that out of the way, and then you can do the things that are fun that do need that expansive sense of time to accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's really good advice because I know for many of us, our lives are so full, and carving out that time to be still, reflect, and let your mind just wander, think, what about this? What about the what if? Is one we don't often give ourselves. Our lives are so full of pre-digested opinions. Like, if you look at a newspaper feed, you will find the headline stories, the news stories, and you'll find all kinds of ways to think about it supplied to you in the opinion pieces down below. And so for people to actually have original thoughts is actually quite hard given the bombardment they have of pre-digested opinions. So I think it's a really good reminder to think of the whole idea of giving yourself free space, free time to let those mature in your thinking.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Malcolm, this has been a fascinating glimpse into your personal process. Thank you so much. And also a glimpse into the ideas you come up with. I can't wait to see where you go next. And if that peer effects idea doesn't work out, I'm sure there'll be five more hot in his heels, and they will be fascinating to hear and
Well, thank you.
follow
Yeah.
along with you. So thank you ever so much for sharing those things with us. And again, I can't wait to see the next creative explosion you come up with.
Great. Thank you, Dawson.
All the best.
Bye-bye.